Here is a set of synthesis problems. Now, I think I had indicated that we were going to be doing synthesis practice today, but what I've decided might be time-wise more efficient is let you all do this as homework. Work on it between now and Thursday. Then Thursday, we can go over the answers. So that takes away a little bit of the immediate panic, but it will give you a better chance to tackle some of these. Because especially the one that I did write extra tough, that is sort of a difficult one. It's not impossible, and you can do it with what reactions you have learned so far, but it might take you a little bit of thinking. Unless I totally missed something, there's a trick that I just wasn't expecting. I think that's what I wanted. A couple of these other ones are easier, a couple of them are not so easy. So Thursday we'll go over the answers. I would appreciate if some of you would work on them between now and Thursday. Your section didn't seem to resist the idea of presenters nearly as much, but don't make me call on presenters to make you want to do the homework. Take the chance to do some of these synthesis practices. What we're going to do today instead of doing the synthesis is to start on conjugation. Because I'm guessing that if I asked you all right now, if I gave you a pop quiz and asked you to describe bonds and antibonds, the difference between a sigma and a pi bond, and why bonds lower in energy and antibonds higher, that you all stare at and think, we learned all that once. But you need all that because we're going to be continuing to conjugation, which is just an extension of the type of molecular orbital theory that we've already covered. So I'm not going to re-lecture on everything that we did last quarter, but I am going to do kind of a synopsis of the main ideas. And I guess I'll start at the beginning. Because molecular orbital theory is based off atomic orbitals. We have a way of using atomic orbitals to represent both the structure of molecules and bonding. But there's There's a problem that arises when you're trying to describe orbitals, or, you know what, let me just start that whole thought process over again, because I'm looking at what we did yesterday, and somehow I started this off beautifully, but let me think of the intro. Because we're going to try to be talking about bonding. Bonding is an interaction between two, or as we're going to talk about, two or more atoms. Why does a bond form? There's a good place to start. Why does a bond form? Something to be more stable. What does more stable mean? Well, not octet, because not everything follows octet rule. Bonding occurs because energy is released, and that's the model that we need to redevelop. Last quarter, we talked about two different ways of showing that release of energy. We talked about plus and minus charges and whether they're attracted to each other or repelled by each other. But if we're talking about little charges, then we're treating them as particles, which is the wrong picture, because subatomic particles really act like waves. So we have to have some kind of description of the bond that takes into account the wave behavior of an atom, or an electron, I should say. And that's how we end up talking about atomic orbitals. Because if you're going to be talking about waves, you're going to be talking about wave functions, quantum mechanics, you got to start with an individual atom, which is a complicated enough story as it is. Unfortunately, we can't use the atomic orbitals directly to describe bonding. So even though you might spend all that effort to understand atomic orbitals, in one sense you'd have to say, well, it all needs to be thrown away if we're talking about molecules. Except there is a way to use atomic orbitals to model what happens in molecules and model what happens in bonds. And I guess that's the connection we need to start with. How do we make the transition from atomic orbitals to molecular orbitals? Why is there such a transition? So, starting with atomic orbitals, why is it, or let me ask this question, is there really such a thing as an atomic orbital if you've got a molecule? No, why not? Because that's what we do, but why can't you just use atomic orbitals directly? Because there's more than one nucleus present. So the unique shapes that atomic orbitals make, if you think about them, the S orbital is completely symmetric around the center, around the nucleus. A P orbital is evenly split in half at the point of the nucleus. A D orbital is a flower shape, again with the nucleus right in the center. So all those unique shapes are created by the fact that you've got just one nucleus. Well, as soon as you put a second nucleus into the system, then you're going to have attractions between the electron and both of those nuclei, which is automatically going to change the shape of the orbital that you have. And so that's our first set of thoughts there, that atomic orbitals, which I'm going to abbreviate those AOs from now on, describe the possible location of electrons in a mononuclear system. It means something that only has one nucleus. Now, there's a further thought that actually came up in the lecture yesterday, which is that these equations for atomic orbitals can be exactly solved as long as there's only one electron around. Now, when I say polynuclear, that doesn't refer to the number of protons. So regardless of number of protons, if you have just one electron, you can actually sit down and work through the integrals to come up with the equations for atomic orbitals. When you start having multiple electrons, then there's too many bodies in that problem. You can't come up with enough equations to solve for the system. But atomic orbitals still exist. We just can't write the nice equations for them. And as I said a moment ago, all atomic orbitals have shapes that depend on there being only one nucleus present. And then we get to the next part of the problem, which is what do we do when we get to a bond? Because a bond has multiple nuclei, and if you have multiple nuclei, then at least directly, we can't use the atomic orbitals. As we'll see in the models that we use, sometimes we'll use atomic orbitals because it gives a good enough picture of what's going on. So molecules contain bonds. Which are interactions between two, or here's the key part for this quarter, two or more atoms. Because multiple nuclei are involved, atomic orbitals cannot be directly used to explain molecular structure. On the side here, I'll put in parentheses methane. Why? Because this is the example that whether it's Chem 1 or Chem 12, I always use to show how atomic orbitals won't work in a molecular system. Because if you recall, for carbon, we have the valence orbitals of carbon, which are S and P orbitals, and they're different shapes from each other. And they're also different energies than each other. That's one key thing that happens in polyelectronic systems. That because of the multiple electrons that are there, it ends up causing a difference in the energies of different kinds of orbitals that are all part of the same shell. Meaning, if you only had one electron, technically SPDF orbitals are the same energy as each other, but they're not in most atoms. But if you look at methane, methane is a molecule where the bond angles are 109.5 degrees, which doesn't match at all either the S or P orbitals in terms of geometry. And all the bonds in methane are equal in energy to each other. But the different orbitals in carbon are different energies from each other. So what we do is this thing called hybridization, where we blend the different atomic orbitals. We don't throw away all that work to understand atomic orbitals. We just use it by creating a model where we add and subtract the different ones, the different atomic orbitals on the same atom, to come up with hybrids that are going to match the real-life geometry of that system. So we're not really going to get into what hybridization is again, but just because we're doing this summary, I want to include a mention of it. So hybridization involves combining atomic orbitals, and here's the key part, on the same atom. To create new molecular orbitals. That match the geometry of the molecule. And in parentheses here, I'll say that that is, in other words, to match the predictions of Vesper theory. So Vesper theory is a very simplified theory that gives us a good prediction of what the different shapes of molecules are going to be, and it's just based off of repulsion, that like-charged objects are trying to get as far away from each other as possible. Of course, once you do that, we end up with a geometry that, again, doesn't match all the atomic orbitals, but because of the crazy symmetry that's in atomic orbitals, we can combine them and magically somehow get these different hybrids that happen to have just the right shapes. Of course, that still doesn't get us to bonding, per se. That just helps create an orbital set to explain the structure. But then bonding, what we do is the same type of thing. Except instead of adding and subtracting orbitals on the same atom, we're going to add and subtract orbitals on different atoms. And that's the difference. Bonding can be represented by combining atomic orbitals on different atoms. And to show an example of this, I want to start with a sigma bond, which is what we did last quarter. But instead of starting with just a plain hydrogen-hydrogen sigma bond, since this is review and not the first time we're doing it, I want to take a slightly more complicated situation, which is the sigma bond that we would have in the molecule methane. Part of the reason for me doing this example is we do have new people this quarter, so they need to at least once give a more formal treatment of what a structural molecular orbital graph is. Because you will need to be drawing these kinds of structures, or these type of diagrams, to show me molecular structure, although And I don't mean to do this to confuse you. You do have to recognize there's going to be a second type of diagram. Now, the smog diagram essentially shows you the different types of orbitals on a molecule, but doesn't look at all at the sign of the wave function. So in case any of you have forgotten what this wave function thing is, if an electron is a wave, there's a function that must be able to describe it, and that's all a wave function is. A wave function you could also call an orbital, because a wave function describes the space that is an orbital. So wave functions can have plus and minus values. And if you think of a p orbital, when you first learned about a p orbital, maybe you learned that you shade one half one way and shade one half the other. And that's because mathematically, if we look at the equation, one half is a negative sign, one half is a positive. It has nothing to do with charge. Electrons always negative. It has to do with the function. That kind of information you don't put in a smog diagram. So a smog diagram is a graphical depiction of the types of orbitals present in a molecule, again, ignoring wave function sign. Now, I might have mentioned this quarter, but I don't think I showed for the new people the way that I represent hybrid orbitals. Because, for example, if we had an sp3 hybrid and we did use shading, then it would look something like this. Now, where you have the two different types of shading switching from one to the other, that means you're flipping the sign of the equation, and that's what a node is. A node is any point where the equation is equal to zero. And all hybrids have this node, which, if you think about it, if you take an s orbital and put it on top of a p orbital, you're supposed to be adding these two things together. Well, the s orbital is going to add the one half of the p orbital because it'll be the same mathematical sign, but it'll shrink the other half because it'll be opposite sign. And that's how we end up with this lopsided diagram. But instead of trying to put all the little tails in there, which makes the diagram more complicated to read and draw, I long ago made the decision to simplify, where I'll just write one of the lobes of that orbital. So it's not that it disappears, it's because I'm being lazy, but I'm also trying to be clear. So what would a smog diagram look like for a simple molecule like methane? Well, you draw in a picture of all the different types of orbitals that are present, which there's only two. There's the sp3 orbital, which is what we have between carbon and hydrogen. And if I say sp3, that automatically means there's four of them. And then, of course, there are the four hydrogens. Last quarter, I had developed a coloring system to try to maintain some consistency in the way that I was drawing orbitals. So purple was the color I usually did for sp3, and an s orbital was usually black. Now, let me point out that this is a fake diagram, because these orbitals don't even exist. Because if you have bonds, again, a bond is an interaction between more than one atom. Well, how can you have separate orbitals on separate atoms that are somehow sharing the electron? They don't. But we do this kind of drawing so that we can understand the structure. But then at the same time, we have to recognize, well, technically, there is a bond there, and it really needs a bonding orbital to describe it. So what we're going to do now is a molecular orbital energy diagram, which is different from a smog, and it's the type of thing that you would have done back in Chem 1A, where you write the atomic orbitals that are going to go into making that bond on the side of the diagram, and then you write the new orbitals that are formed, the bond and the antibond, in the middle of the diagram. I'm going to put sp3 on the left arbitrarily and s on the right, but it's not arbitrary that I've written the sp3 above the s. And notice that I've already labeled my y-axis as energy, so I'm explicitly stating the sp3 orbital is higher in energy than s, which we could easily make that statement if we were on the same atom. I would possibly caution that I didn't look this up ahead of time, and so I'm just guessing that an s orbital on a hydrogen is lower than an sp3 orbital on a carbon. If we ignored the difference between the types of atoms involved, why could you say it makes sense that the sp3 orbital is higher in energy than s? Okay, so you're both saying that it's a combination of s and p orbitals. Well, why does the fact that there's some portion of a p orbital in there matter? You both are saying that the reason there's a difference in energy because you've got some p orbitalness, or the way we said it last quarter, p orbital character, p character in the sp3 orbital. Why does that cause it to be higher in energy? That effectively, because of shielding, electrons in a p orbital are on average held further away from the nucleus, which makes them higher in energy. And so the more like a p orbital it looks, the higher an energy is going to be, which is exactly the argument that we made last quarter to explain why an alkyne is more acidic than an alkene is more acidic than alkane. Because an sp orbital that's 50% s is going to better tolerate, which means be lower in energy, with an anion than if you had 1/3 of an s orbital, which would be sp2, or 1/4 an s orbital, or yes, s orbital, which is sp3. But even though they're different in energy, they're close enough that they can interact with each other. And we do form two different things. A bond, which to anticipate is a sigma bond, and then an antibond, which we often use a star to show something as an antibond. I'll talk about why I know it's a sigma bond just momentarily. But the fact that we end up with two orbitals is because we have two nuclei involved. The number of molecular orbitals generated in one of these kinds of bonding systems is, because of symmetry, always equal to the number of... Number of molecular orbitals generated is always equal to the number of atoms that are involved. So we had two atoms making the bond, and so we end up with two bonding orbitals. How do we fill this up? Well, if you think about methane's case, that's a relatively straightforward one to analyze, because you've got carbon that's got 4 valence electrons, each hydrogen has 1 valence electron, and you could imagine, therefore, that 1 electron each comes from carbon to be in that sp3 hybrid versus 1 electron each in the s orbital. Things roll downhill, and so by creating these new bonding orbitals, we're going to end up with 2 electrons in the bond, none in the antibond. Now, one thing about this that confuses people often is, wait, if you got an antibonding orbital, how come that molecule exists? Because doesn't an antibond cancel out a bond? Well, yes, but it's more correct to say an antibonding electron cancels out a bonding electron. In other words, the electrons themselves are the bond, are the antibond. These orbitals are just space, and space itself does nothing. So once you put an electron in it, that's when the effect happens. So the fact that we have electrons in the bonding orbital and not in the antibonding orbital means we really do have a bond. And if you think back to either the sodium reduction of an alkyne or the initiation of a Grignard reagent, both of those involve putting an electron into a bond that already existed. Well, if you see this diagram, this shows the empty place where an electron like that could go. It would go into the antibond. Had a discussion in office hours yesterday about some homework I guess I'm going to have to do over the break, about the molecule O2 minus, which bio people, I guess you are learning about that as being a free radical. And the question was asked, well, what happens to O2 minus? How does it react further? Being a chemist, that would be a perfectly fair question to ask me. But unfortunately, I had to give the unfair answer of, I don't know. So I'll have to figure that out. But anyways, this is where these diagrams come into play, examining what kinds of bonds do we have, how many electrons are there, and do we therefore have anything in an antibond? That's part of the picture. Another part of the picture is, well, what do these orbitals look like? And that's where we use the atomic orbitals again. We use them already here to make the energy diagram, but then we use them geometrically to show the shapes of the orbitals, the bonds that form. Now, this is going to look quite a bit different from the hydrogen example from last quarter. I'm doing it on purpose because you're all one quarter more sophisticated students. You can handle the slightly meatier examples. So if we had an sp3 orbital, it's going to have one lobe that's larger than the other. And I am going to be drawing these with sign, because if we're talking about bonding and we're talking about adding and subtracting orbitals, we're talking about adding and subtracting equations. So we have to know where it's plus, and we have to know where it's minus. We have it interacting with an s orbital. It is unknown and arbitrary which sign of the wave function that we use. Because remember, these orbitals don't exist in the first place. So it's not that the orbital is somehow interacting one way and interacting the other. Because what I'm about to do is put a plus sign between these and say, let's add these together. That's not what happens in real life. That's our model that we use. And I can say that a zillion times, and I think I may have said it enough last quarter, that that is an acceptable thought to you all. But when I first would teach this topic, I'd get endless questions about, well, how can it combine both ways? And eventually I figured out, well, it doesn't combine because it doesn't exist. It's our way of getting our minds wrapped around what bonding is. When I say that I'm going to add these things together, I literally mean, both geometrically and equation-wise, put one on top of the other. Well, of course, if they match in terms of sign, then that's something we call constructive interference, which means the two functions reinforce each other, and we end up with a fatter orbital, which to better show what's really going on here, I'm going to put a green line, in this case not to represent the node, but just to show you where the center of each atom is. Because you could then see that in this bottom example, we end up with this new orbital where we have electrons between the two nuclei, which in complicated symbology I would write this way. And you'll see why I'm going to represent it that way next lecture. But this is related to the question, why does a bond form? Or more specifically, I remember a question from last quarter that I asked, why is a bond lower in energy? To which some of you answered, a bond is lower in energy because it's lower in energy. I mean, you didn't literally answer like that, but I said, why is it lower in energy? You said, well, because it's below on the graph. Well, yes, it is, but the question's telling you it's below. So why is it lower in energy? And the answer is favorable electrostatic interaction. You're putting a negative charge in between two positive charges. That reduces how much each positive charge interacts with each other and increases how much opposite charges act with each other. which is a favorable thing. That's why a bond happens, because it puts electrons in favorable places. Well, what's an antibond then? Well, where you do the opposite, where you make it less favorable. So if I added these top two orbitals together, then what you're going to find, in fact, that's not even quite right. Be more like this, even. What used to be the larger lobe will now be the smaller one. The S orbital will kind of get distorted and pushed out away from the nucleus. So again, the green lines are just showing where the center of the two atoms are. And what I'm trying to show here is that there's lack of electrons between nuclei. Which again, in complicated symbology, I could write like this. Because if you're pushing electrons away from the space between the two nuclei, the positive charges are now exposed to each other. I can already see the thoughts. Yes, you can use the smiley and unhappy faces on your exams.
No, I was trying to analyze that bond smiley.
It's smiling. It's just got a little. You could talk about double bond and do that. The reason I'm doing this is because we're about to see systems in which it's not just two orbitals interacting. We're going to have conjugation where you have multiple orbitals, and so you have multiple favorable or unfavorable interactions, and you have to sort out which is greater, the number of favorable interactions or the unfavorable ones, because we're going to use that to decide when is something a bond versus an antibond. To finish what I was about to say here before I distracted myself, the fact that you have no electrons between the two atoms means the two positive charges are more exposed, but yet you're trying to keep the atoms at a fixed distance. That's the part of the picture that sometimes gets lost in the explanation, is you could say, well, the atoms should push away from each other. But we're saying if you've got two nuclei in a position and here's that orbital, what kind of energy do you have? Well, it's high energy because you've exposed the nuclei. Bad electrostatics. That's why an antibond is higher in energy. Yes?
So did the addition of the opposite sign functions create a node?
Yes. So that's in fact what is right in between there. Because anywhere where you have complete cancellation, that's a node, which means the value of the function is zero. And since in the Born interpretation, I almost said the Born's parenthesis. The Born interpretation of quantum mechanics, it's the square of the wave function that's related to the probability of finding an electron somewhere. So if you have a node where the function is zero, that means no electron exists there. Now, why is this a sigma bond? Because the orbitals are all aligned in the same line as each other. And so anytime orbitals overlap like that, not just two S orbitals, any two orbitals overlap sideways like that, that's a sigma bond. What we should do next then is a pi bond, but first let me ask, are there any questions up to this point? Or do you all need a couple of days to ingest this before we continue with questions? Obviously, there's no quiz on this right away, but so let me ask you, how many of you, I'll put it in quotes here, remembered all of this? How many of you think this looks familiar? How many of you are about to panic because you don't remember seeing any of this in 12A? Hopefully you don't raise your, oh, okay, but you came from the outside? You might want to come to office hours at some point, or you want to make really sure that you get some help going back to the 12A notes, because we had several lectures over this topic. And if you've never seen it before, you're probably thinking, I took chemistry, but I don't remember any of this. Because not every instructor goes through molecular and atomic orbital theory the way that I think they should. But let's move on to a pi bond then.
But before we do that, you know, there's no good time to do this. But that's where that famous phrase, there's no time like the present.
Functions that can fit that set of boundary conditions. One in which you have just a smooth function that spans between the two points. Or if you're to add enough energy, then you get a function that has a place in the middle where it appears that it's not moving. That's our node. If you were able to take a stop motion picture of this, you would see that the two halves of this wave are pointed always in opposite directions from each other. If you go up one more point in energy, you get a function that is split twice. And then where one part of this pointing is opposite the middle is opposite the other end. The part of this demonstration is to show that there is no 1.5 wave or 2.25 wave. It's either 1 or 2 or 3 different segments that you get. But the only way the wave can exist is, again, at the start and end are at these endpoints. Now, think of it this way. If an atom or an electron is a wave, I'm always worried that it's somehow this is going to dial 111 or something. This is a famous conference. Making sure they're not coming to take me away here. Think of an electron being a wave. Think of a line of p orbitals being like a box that you put that wave into. Well, it turns out that the equation for the wave must fit within that box, means it must end at the two ends of the box. So if you had two p orbitals, one possible wave that could exist across those two p orbitals is for it to just simply connect across. Which if you did that, if this is a wave function, and the maximum value of that wave function is in the middle, right between the two nuclei, that's what we call a bond. And this is the lowest possible energy you could have for that system. You go up one rung in energy, and what happens? You put a node right between the two ends, which if you're talking about a pi bond, one atom's here, one atom's there, there's a node in between, that's the antibond. Where we're going with this is what happens if you have 3 p orbitals. Well, you potentially could have one wave that spans across like this. That's one energy level. Another energy level where there's one node in between, and another energy level where there's two nodes in between. Let's see how we model that on one of these bonding diagrams.
I wonder if I can get some department money to buy a really, really good cord to do that demonstration one day. Because it's, you know, I'm one of those, I guess, handful of people that actually, at one point, I don't know if I've lost that idea, I just don't do it anymore. I used to think math was cool. Yeah, I know, it's like, you're all like, oh, stop it, Dr. Gray, you're making it worse for yourself. And I'm in chemistry, so quantum mechanics is that junction between the two. And trying to explain to a set of students all this about standing waves, if you do anything with spectroscopy in the future, it all comes back to this exact same theory. So if any of you are going to take P-Chem, how many of you know that you're going to have to take physical chemistry? You all are going to get away without having to take, oh, you're going to have to take it? You're going to see this again, all these standing waves. So I'm sure you're thinking whoopee right now, but
P-chem, for all those of you who don't have to take it, it's where you go back and do general chem except with multivariable calculus. And so all the places in general chem where they said, oh, you'll get that later, well, that's when you get it. Anyways, back to bonding and antibonding. We have a pi bond. How can we represent that? Two different ways, the two types of bonds that form. We represent it by using two different p orbitals. In real life, there's some kind of orbital that forms. This is just our way of modeling it. To relate this to the foam core demonstration, another way to model it is to say the lowest energy standing wave possible is one that bridges between the two endpoints. The next lowest energy wave possible is a wave that has one node in between. Well, if we were to add two p orbitals with the same sign of the wave function, then that's what we're going to generate. Two new lobes, a shape in which the sign is the same all the way across. If instead we added two p orbitals with opposite sign, then we're going to generate an orbital with a shape that looks like this. It has a node between the nuclei. So here we have electrons between nuclei, again favorable, and here we have no electrons, which is unfavorable. Where you have electrons between, that drops the energy, so we call that a pi bond. And then where you do have cancellation, so it's higher energy, you end up with an antibond. Yes? Second one, what? This? This is more what the orbital really looks like what a pi. That's because you start out with an orbital, you have a system that already has a node through the atoms. But we don't look at that because that's already part of the system. The fact that you start out with a p orbital means it's potentially higher energy than an s orbital, but then when bonding and antibonding happen, since you already have that node through the two nuclei, it doesn't influence whether or not it's a bond or an antibond. It matters what happens between the two nuclei. So what happens if we have the allyl case? Well, first let's do a smog for that. Which each of the atoms on each of the carbons there would be sp2 hybridized. When we say sp2 hybrid, that automatically means we have three hybrid orbitals, which from experience, I know that I'm going to be writing a p orbital superimposed on top of all of these. So I'm going to draw my sp2s carefully enough that I don't interfere with my being able to draw the p orbitals later on. And blue is the color that I usually did sp2s in. We do, of course, have a flock of hydrogens. And then we have p orbitals. And I know this came up last quarter because I must have asked a question like this before. Which of the p orbitals overlap? All of them. Or as section ones and twos said yesterday, they said yes. And they said no. Which, if in case you hadn't heard the story yet, that's because my dad, when you used to ask him, are we going to go today or tomorrow to someplace, he'd answer yes. Because you're going to go. So the answer to the question, are you going to go, is yes. Now, today or tomorrow, that's not really important because that's not what you're really asking. You were asking, are you going to go today or tomorrow? And the answer is yes. So if I ask you, is it the left two or the right two orbitals that overlap? The answer is yes. because they completely overlap, which is the whole point of what resonance is and conjugation is. Resonance is the fact we can't write one structure for a molecule because the bond doesn't exist just between two atoms. And we don't have a writing system that handles bonds that span multiple atoms. This also has, therefore, an effect on how many energy levels there are. Because when we had just two orbitals involved in bonding, it made two new molecular orbitals. But because of symmetry, when we have three atomic orbitals that go in, we're going to have three molecular orbitals that come back out. We're going to have the p orbitals be used to represent those three molecular orbitals. And the question is, how do we properly use the p orbitals to show what the real molecular orbitals look like? Well, let's superimpose it on top of it, the same type of wave pattern that you saw earlier with the phone cord. Because it might make sense that the lowest energy orbital that's possible is if all the p orbitals have the same sign of the wave function, which would match a wave that spans only in the plus or the minus direction across the system. If we go to the top system, you notice the way that the wave I have there, there are two nodes in it. So if I'm keeping track of the number of nodes, we have 0 and 2. Number of nodes matter because that's related to the principal energy level. That's what N in the MLMS is. Really, it's the total number of nodes, minus 1. But that's another detail for another day. But if we did have a node between each atom, that means that we have cancellation between each atom. So down here, I could show that I've got two favorable interactions. Well, that means that this is going to end up being a bond. Up top, I can show that I have two unfavorable interactions. And that means I have an antibond. But what about the middle picture? Because this wave way of representing the orbital, I have a node that passes right in the middle, passes right through where one of the atoms is. What does that mean? We don't use that atomic orbital in representing the molecular orbital. Again, the confusion I used to get in the past is, wait, how can an orbital disappear? None of them exist in the first place, so don't worry about it disappearing. It's not there. It's just we don't use it to represent the molecular orbital. The node passes right through it. If so, we could write one shading on one atom on one side, the opposite shading on the other atom on the opposite side, which they're too far apart from each other that they don't interact. It's neither favorable nor unfavorable, and it's what we therefore called a non-bond, energetically zero relative to the original atoms. And where we're going to go is building this up to four p orbitals, seeing what those molecular orbitals look like. In theory, we can then do 5, 6, 7, any number of p orbitals. And that's what we do for conjugated systems. When we then slide into benzene, we take it and wrap it in a circle, which causes an extra form of symmetry to develop, but I'll show you that when we're ready for it, when we're ready for benzene. We are totally out of time for today. So you have your lab quiz on Thursday. We start with that. Those of you who tend to show up late to lab, come on time, because we'll start the lab quiz right at 7:30. Any time left, we will do IRs, or depending on what I think we can get through lecture that day, we might do some of the synthesis problems right after the lab quiz.
Okay.